Ogden was going to go ahead with it. And, that's what I wanted to find out from Wesley. It's supposed to be in the northern part of Poland. I'm just wondering if it's near a river or a lake or, you know, that type of thing. Or, you know, how are they going to cool this down? You know, there's different ways to cool it down, primarily with these cooling towers. But there's other exotic things that are out there, too, you know. But I haven't figured that out yet. And, of course, the pressure system is going to be standard. You know, you'll have your nuke, all the rods will be in the water, and that water will supposed to be going through pumps. And those pumps will go through heat exchangers. The heat exchangers, of course, will be the ones that will eventually feed, become steam for the generators. That part will be standard. So I'm just wondering about the cooling system that they're going to use. We'll find out as time goes on, though.
Come on, let me just clear the
KD2WOT.
Yeah, Chris?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, there are two brand new reactors actually going into production, located in Georgia at Southern Company. It's a site with two reactors already. This is the number three and number four that they filed permits a number of years ago, and they've just completed, and they began loading fuel just the 13th of October.
Okay. Special, but just more of the same.
Oh, Roy, that was a beautiful bubble. I assume it's all. Why don't you start all over and turn it to the other station?
Okay, sounds like a plan. I just wanted to thank Chris for the information. Also wanted to mention that according to what I've been reading, these reactors are not anything novel, not any new design. 6 to 9 gigawatts energy, and they won't be ready for action until the 2030s, up until the 2040s or so. So we're talking, they're going to start building it first in 2026, probably. And the first one will be commissioned someplace around 2033, if everything works out. And then subsequent units will be implemented every 2 to 3 years, according to their plan. So nothing esoteric. We're not going to be changing the technology, unfortunately. It'd be interesting to see if that was possible. There are stories about test reactors that are lower risk, but no one wants to invest the research money right now. And Paul, over to you.
Okay, sorry, I doubled. Anyway, I was going to say, the reactors down in Georgia, over 10 years ago, they get the approval, but before that, there was nothing, like for 30 years, because of the sentiment against the nuclear power plants. Now it's stuck. If you look on Google Maps and you zoom into an area, they have one down in Florida near where that hurricane was, and you zoom in, there's acres and acres and acres of these solar panels, and in different areas that have it. You have it out here in Suffolk County, too. It's a big area. It's good, but the power that they put out is not going to be able to place what the nuclear power plants could do. If they want to get away from coal and oil, they've got to bite the bullet and just build more of these things, I think. Anyway, that's what I was trying to say. Back to you, Ron.
There's something I wanted to ask.
Okay, Ed, head away.
Most nuclear power plants use, like, enriched uranium, a so-called hot water system. Plastic water, nothing exotic right there. There are talks, I don't know if it's ever happened, but maybe some test plants using molten sodium instead of water. The beauty of the water, is actually necessary for the nuclear reaction. One reason it's very popular if you have a catastrophic failure of the water cooling systems, also the power transfer system. Just like on a old-fashioned coal or oil-fired boiler, you boil water and run a turbine. The beauty of the water system of the reactor is the nuclear reaction requires the water. So if you have a catastrophic failure and all the water runs out, there will be damage from the residual heat, but the nuclear reaction will shut down.
So the water acts as a thermal neutron device that slows down neutrons and improves the chance of chain reactions?
As I understand it, the neutrons are going too fast. Doesn't work. Water tends to act like a speed brake on the neutrons, and it's designed to do that for that specific reason. You'll lose the water, you'll lose the reaction.
Okay, I mean, that's also what the carbon rods do when they control the reactor. They're either slowing down the neutrons, which increases the chain reaction and heats things up, or if they're thermal neutrons, they get right past with a much lower chance of chain reaction going on.
Yeah, but there are both systems that the coolant is really just a catastrophic emergency shutdown and not used for control. The other one is used to find Bernier control.
Oh, okay. I wasn't aware that water was a good material to slow down thermal neutrons. So I wonder if they dope it with something.
Not to my knowledge. And by the way, one other thing, all reference cooling towers. Realize you have a plant near a large body of water, you don't need the cooling towers. You just need something to get rid of the excess heat. The point is an interesting thing. They drew in and pumped through humongous amounts of river water, cooled down the peak, but they promised they would only raise the temperature of the water going back into the river by something like 2 degrees. This damaging, ancient wildlife. And to do that, they had to take tremendous amounts of river water and mix it with the effluent cooling. Now, cooling towers are these new structures where they basically just spray in water as huge fans blowing up, kind of like in a way like the radiator on your car times a million or so.
Okay. Perusing websites, I can't find any documentation of where the water is coming from, whether they're going to just store it up and reuse it, or they're going to plant it next to some river. There's really no geographic information that I can find on the web. Okay, I'm not quite sure. Maybe I doubled with you. Paul and you doubled just a second ago. I'm just saying that I'm going through websites, and although I find interesting information, there's pretty much nothing on geography. So there's no indication of whether they're going to place it next to a lake or next to a river. Right now, that information is probably not available yet.
Okay, yeah, that would tell me whether or not they're going to be using cooling towers or not. Remember, 3 Mile Island, they have the big cooling towers. Very good. I'll go over it with Wesley. He probably knows the area. Anyway, back to you, Warren.
Okay, very good. Once again, it's AC2GS. We're closing this segment. Anyone with any comments before I turn it over, please hit that push-to-talk button. Certainly, yes.
Well, I had that tour of Indian Point. We were told that some people had decided that the, like, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, that the effluent water from the Indian Point plant raised the temperature of that part. I'm not saying it changed the river temperature. Water entering the river had to be 2 degrees above the temperature going in. And some people would say, oh, no, that's too much. They wanted to build a water tower, which I said to our tour guide. And this is a rather high-priced residential area. Something tells me a humongous structure like that would not be too popular with the neighbors. It looks like you have no idea.
Yeah, well, you got to factor that into the equation. They all vote, they pay taxes, they do all kinds of things. When they get angry, you know, wealthy people are probably more dangerous than poor people when they get angry. So you got to keep it all in mind.
Witness the curve in the northern state. You know that one, Roy? You're a city boy.
No, I don't. You want to tell me quickly? If you could do it quickly, because I don't want Paul to wait too long.
Going out from the city into Nassau, the northern state pretty much parallels the LIE. I mean, the northern state was built first, but they're pretty much parallel. At Glen Cove Road, the northern state takes a dive to the south, takes about 10 miles to get back up to where it's up to the LIE. When Robert Moses was laying out the northern state, when the LIE was in the pipe dream, by the way, routed around his friend's mansion.
Well, good old Robert Moses. I still remember I read that ridiculously thick book. It had to be 1,200 pages on this guy, his entire life. And, geez, what a god-awful human being.
You mean Robert Caro's The Power Broker?
Yes, indeed. I when it got into paperback many, 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 many years ago, it was ridiculously long, but it was sort of a fascinating example of a smart guy who just was allowed to do anything he felt like.
What bothers me more is how the course, what the course Bronx did to the surrounding neighborhood, South Bronx.
Yes, indeed. He did not like people. He did not like mass transit. He did not like people. He liked parks. He liked cars. He didn't drive cars. He was driven by cars, but he didn't drive cars. So, and I don't think he liked any human being. Maybe himself. Maybe his friends. I don't know. Curious, very skilled manager, but probably a sociopath.
I, for a while, worked in the Robert Moses building on Randall's Island.
Well, you know, back in the good old days when he was in his prime, he was God. He was the last statement. You know, he could have anything that he wanted somehow. And, you know, with all gods, after a time, you discover their feet of clay.
Elon Musk is going through today, but I don't think we really want to go down that rabbit hole.
No. We don't want to touch that with a 10-foot ball. Although we might have our own little separate Elon Musk net. You know, I think in the years to come, this is going to be full of stories to be told. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. I hope people learned a few things and had a little bit of fun themselves. And I hope you'll come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. Now it's time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report. So take it away, Paul.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report. And okay, on Moses, well, he gave us those parkways, you know, we you can't put a, even today, you can't put a truck on a road. The bridges are all too low. I mean, what a great idea. At least he gave us a joke, you know. You know, you could, why do we drive on the parkways and park on the driveways? So, anyway, let me drop it.
By the way, you know why those whole bridges are there?
Again, a little noisy, Ed.
You know why those low bridges are there? He didn't want buses coming out from the city.
Is that what it was? He wanted parkways. He wanted to have a car ride through like it was riding through a park. That's what I remember. But the bridges, well, anyway, now you can't put a tractor trailer through it without changing everything. So, not good. Okay. Let me just start off with a launch that was supposed to go off early this morning. And anyway, it's going to wind up going off tomorrow morning at 5:30. And that's the Antares Cygnus launch from Wallops Island. So I guess if you're up real early in the morning, which I won't be, you could look out toward the south or southwest and maybe get, if you're high enough without trees, maybe get a glimpse of the rocket engines of the Antares rocket launching off from Wallops Island, Virginia. You know, it's been done before. I actually did it once. Anyway, this is another cargo flight to the International Space Station with over 8,000 pounds worth of stuff. When Cygnus first started going up, you know, they were in a 4,000 pound category. Then they created extended Cygnus modules, which were essentially longer and more power for the engines, and they were able to eventually, you know, work their way up to 8,000 pounds. They had one failure early on, I think it was the fourth mission, and that delayed them for a year and a half. And then during that period of time, they got the Atlas V to launch the Cygnus on top just for two missions. Then they went back to Antares, and that's it. They were delayed. They were supposed to go off this morning, and it was delayed because they had a fire in the command center, or a fire alarm. I never did find out if it was an actual fire. One of the deals where, you know, everybody outside the building, and then, you know, by the time they got back in and got everything working, it was, you know, already too late, so they just delayed it for another 24 hours. So this one is called the Sally Ride. All the Cygnus spacecraft get named after astronauts that have passed on. And so they're going to name it, or they have already named it the Sally Ride Cygnus vehicle. And we'll see it dock, and I'll pay attention to what they're doing. They're bringing up a lot of science in this particular group, 8,000 pounds worth of, you know, food, clothes, you know, things like that, water. But they have a lot of science in this particular flight. The International Space Station is generally running around 300 experiments of different types, you know, on a regular basis. You know, a lot of them are being controlled and operated by the astronauts, and a lot of them, the astronauts don't even touch. Some of them are now been on the outside of the space station. Some of the ones on the inside are being controlled by the mission control down in Houston. So, okay, before I move on, any comments? A bunch of other flights for November. China had the final module go up. They had three big modules. Each module is 14 feet long, around 60 feet in diameter. And they have two of them up there for their space station. And they wanted to add the third. It was, you know, this was the plan all along, to do these three. And then they'll have a permanent crew of three, which they have now on board the space station. They have future plans of maybe making it larger, building more modules. But anyway, you would now have a permanent crew up there. Interesting thing that they're doing with one of the future missions. They're going to launch a Hubble-type telescope, a little different than Hubble. It's going to be able to see like 300 times the field of view. But they're going to launch one, and instead of putting into a high orbit where Hubble is, they're going to put it into the same 42 degree inclination that their space station is at. They have a different inclination than what we have with NASA. NASA is 51.6 degrees. But they plan on having a telescope not too far from the space station. This way, if they want to upgrade it or if the problems occur, it will have a docking ring and be able to actually dock with the existing space station. It's a pretty cool idea. And you know, time marches on. We were the only ones with a space station before us. The Russians were the only ones. And now we have combined space station, the International Space Station, with over 20 countries participating. And now we have China Space Station all by themselves. They're looking for partners. They're looking for foreign countries to join them. We'll see how that goes with their situation. It won't be NASA. We don't cooperate with China. They have on a couple of experiments, but that's about it. That's why you don't see China part of the space station, our space station, or we won't see NASA as part of theirs. You might see Russia. That's about it. Any comments? WS-20. Okay, moving right along. Another launch in November. A lot of things going on in November. There's going to be a Japanese lunar lander called Herkutel. Herkutel is the name of this first one. Well, they call it an M1, eventually it's going to be an M2 and 3, all the way up to 10. But this is their first one. They actually had a lot of it built in Germany. Sent over to the United States. It's going to be launched on a Falcon 9 rocket a couple of weeks from now, on the 22nd of November. Anyway, this little lander is designed to go into a polar orbit, but eventually it's not going to land on a pole. It's going to land... if you look at the moon, northeast, roughly northeast of center of the moon, and it'll be, of course, their first lunar lander, again launched by a Falcon 9 rocket. And on board the lander, they have a small rover, not built by us, built by the United Arab Emirates, called the Rashid. Small rover. I don't know, maybe with the mast extended, maybe it's about, I don't know, no more than 3 feet above the surface, but that'll be as high as the camera goes. It's a four-wheel vehicle, solar-powered. They expect it to last, maybe the 14 days of daylight on the moon at the most. And it has color cameras, it has an infrared detector, and a couple of other things. They want to evaluate the dust on the lunar surface to actually try to figure out why the dust is so sticky. It sticks to everything when you're up there. So good luck to Japan. Last two landers that I remember, the countries tried to land. One was from Israel, that didn't work out. And another one from India, that one didn't work out. India had the head of India, Modi. He was actually there waiting for this thing to land. But not all that easy. He spent a lot of time, a lot of money on these landers. it's going to work out. We'll see if this one does. This company was trying for the $30 million Google Prize years ago. Google ran a competition to see who could company, you know, private company, commercial company would land on the moon first. So far, none of them have done it. It expired, the $30 million prize expired in 2018. We are, 4 years later. But this company's still at it. They wanted to be able to do it. And they have, roughly every year, they plan on launching another one of these things. Naturally, each one will be more complex, and, you know, they plan on eventually resupplying NASA with materials, things on the surface of the moon, on the South Pole, where we plan on putting a base. So they got big plans. But one of the pieces of a satellite that's going along with this is actually going to be an orbiting satellite. NASA has put a satellite that will separate from the lunar lander and rover before this thing gets to the moon. It'll be on a polar orbit, and it's called a flashlight. And what it has is this laser beam attached to it. So you can imagine it's going to be a highly elliptical orbit. I think it's going to be, like, I don't know, 1,000 miles or so. At its apogee, and then the low point will be around a little less than 9 miles high, maybe even a little lower, they said, at some point in the future. The lower they can get it, the better it is, because they plan on shining this laser directly into the craters, some of these craters on the South Pole. Here's they've evaluated the lunar surface, and they've made the determination that the poles, besides these dark areas, they're always dark, have ice that you could eventually melt, turn into water, turn into hydrogen or oxygen, you know, free oxygen to freeze, or hydrogen to, you know, as a fuel. But, you know, say that that's true. They believe it is. This will be another way of confirming it, with this flashlight being able to look into directly into craters. On another note, last week I wound up going on a, call it a Zoom or lecture that they had from Houston. They had the assistant director of science from the LPI, the Lunar Planetary Institute. He gave a talk it was primarily the Apollo 16. He wanted to talk about Apollo 15 and 17 missions, all the science that they brought back, and the rocks, and how they did it. You know, a nice presentation, you know, one picture after the other. But he, you know, it was only supposed to be Apollo 16 and 17. He covered all of them, from 11 all the way through, you know, all the ones that landed, the six missions that landed. Very, very well done. You know, he brought up the possibility of water on the moon and what they're looking for. But he, you know, he's gung-ho with Artemis. He hopes they have many missions. He wants to not only investigate the South Pole, he hopes they go to different places that haven't been investigated. Rest of the surface of the moon, and he covered all the different landers. He had pictures of, you know, every different landing site and a story behind every one, about the types of rocks that they brought back, how they got their names, on and on and on. It was very well done. Went on for about almost an hour and a half. Any comments or questions? Okay, another lunar story is Capstone. That was launched by an electron rocket a few months ago, and it will supposedly go into orbit this month around the moon. It's taken that long to get there. It actually went way beyond the probably a couple hundred thousand miles away from the moon, and eventually came to a stop, you know, forward motion. And now the Earth and the moon's gravity is pulling it back slowly. Anyway, it's an inexpensive way to get the get this particular capstone into orbit around the moon. They plan on putting it into a helo, a retro orbit. They call it a halo orbit. And it's going to be the same orbit that eventually the Gateway space station, which is being designed and built now, to eventually be put into lunar orbit. This going into that same orbit, which is highly elliptical. So much so that a normal orbit, let's say you're in where Apollo was at 60 miles above the surface, you know, the command module was going around, it would take a little less than 2 hours for that command module to do that, you know, for every orbit. This thing, to orbit the moon just once, it's going to take up to 11 days. So it's got a perigee of like maybe 1,000 miles, very close, but then an apogee of 40,000 miles away from the moon. And despite having that kind of distance, you're able to orbit the moon only once in maybe 11 days. And that's what Capstone is going to do, and they want to check out the stability of the orbit and give NASA an idea of what they're getting involved with before they start sending their multiple modules out to that location. So we'll see. Anyway, Capstone, it's a short name for Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System Technology Operations and Navigation Experiment. So we'll see how that goes. That had quite a bit of trouble getting it there. One of the small thrusters got, you know, broke and actually was leaking, so it created a spin that was very hard to control. Software knows that something is wrong, and it goes shut down, and then eventually waits for commands from MERS, which eventually they did, and they figured out what was wrong, and now any other maneuvers that they do, they're just going to arrange it where they don't have to fire that one particular thruster. And right now it's under control. They have good calm with it. And we'll see how Capstone goes. Any comments? Okay. NASA came out with a proposal. They're going to start sending out contracts for companies to build lunar rovers for the Artemis program. They know in the future that this is going to be very, very important. It's going to need, the base will be on the South Pole, so the rovers need to be able to operate, of course, in these ridiculously cold temperatures, and they need to survive some parts of the night. You only have like maybe up to 90% daylight in the South Pole, but about 10% of it is going to be dark. So you're going from, you know, plus 250 degrees down to minus 250 degrees, you know, 500 degrees swing. So they need these things to be built robustly. They want it to be able to travel hundreds of miles, not tens of miles. The three rovers that we sent to the moon were on Apollo 15, 16, and 17. And each one simultaneously, the astronauts would travel further and further. You know, so by the time you got to 17, they were going great distances. Over 17 miles was driven on with the rover at some point. And that's about 17 miles away, but, you know, on the odometer. During that presentation I saw the other day, Walter, he was the guy giving the presentation, Walter Kuiper. He by the way, he's been with the Lunar Planetary Institute for decades. Showed a picture with the Apollo 17 rover, the whole path where it went, but superimposed in the background was a picture of Manhattan. Well, you know, you look at it, and it drove the distance from, you know, like 14th Street, you know, all the way up through, you know, through Central Park and then across the Hudson River over to part of New Jersey, you know, and came back and meandered around quite a bit and eventually, you know, back to where it started. And they did three EVAs, so, you know, that was a total of three different trips. But mileage-wise, I mean, they got a couple of, you know, maybe, you know, 3-4 miles, you know, away from, you know, landing site. Drove 17 miles. These new rovers that they want built commercially, they want to be able to go hundreds of miles. The only thing I'm saying is that when they build one, they should build a couple of them. You know, I can't imagine, let's say, two guys going out on a rover, driving, you know, say 50 miles away, and having one break down. So I think they should have it where these things could be pressurized. You're inside. I know that they've done a lot of studies with this. But they're the ones I hope they eventually come up with. You know, if they want one like they had 15, 16, and 17, you know, they were outside. I mean, they were relatively small. You had to have a space suit on. They sat in what looked like beach chairs. You know, that won't be acceptable. I mean, these companies are going to have to build something substantial. Where, you know, you could have maybe a shirt sleeve environment inside, and maybe, you know, when you're driving, you know, put a spacesuit on in case, you know, you flip over and crack the shell or something. But you know, when you're in, you know, a standing position, you should be able to be in a shirt sleeve environment inside one of the rovers. And I think if they're going to go real far away from the Artemis base, they should have two rovers, you know, and follow one another. You know, one with maybe two guys, and then the other one with two guys, but the capability of having four. In case something breaks down, you'd be able to put the other two in yours and drive back and, you know, figure out what you're going to do. What does anybody think? Comments, questions? WS2N.
WB2BXO, Paul.
Hi, Frank. Good evening.
Yeah, hi. Maybe I missed it with regard to the Artemis 1 mission. The one that last I heard was supposed to next proposed launch date is November 14th. Has that successfully been rolled out to the pad? Is there any talk of rolling it back now that there seems to be the possibility of another tropical storm going past Florida? Go ahead.
It is out of the pad now. About two or three days ago. They opened a vehicle assembly building and let it roll. It takes, I think, roughly to make that 4.1-mile trip out to Launch Complex 39B. Sitting there now. Haven't heard if the storm is going to be a problem. If it is, they have certain wind constraints that they can deal with. Last time they were out in the pad, I think they said they could go up to 80 miles an hour at the 100-foot level. So, if anything's going to be over that, then it would have to be brought back to the vehicle assembly building. So we'll see. Right now, you're right, Frank. November 14th is the time, and hopefully they'll be able to launch this time. They have a 69 minute window. This is going to be going off in the middle of the night, by the way. This is going to be going off like 12:07. Right, you know, now you got another hour after that. An hour or two after that, I think, a bunch. Then the window closes. Hopefully they get this thing off the ground. It's going to be a nighttime launch, of course, which I thought they were really going to hope for. I'm sure they were, but orbital mechanics felt that they would have to wait maybe another month or so before they got a daytime launch. We'll see. And I haven't seen how many day mission it will be. Initially, when it was supposed to go up in September, it was going to be a 39-day mission, and then they shortened it to a 36-day mission because of orbital mechanics when they were delaying it, and it will probably be about the same this time. They suppose when you have the hydrogen leak problem solved, they know pretty much now it has to do with system on how they fill the rate that they fill, they start filling. Hydrogen leaks very easily. So they ran through a wet dress rehearsal last time before they brought it back to the vehicle assembly building, and it all went well. I mean, they filled up the whole system with 700,000 gallons worth of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, including the second stage, which is also liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They filled that up as well. And they really are set. So we'll see if they get off the ground. Back to you, Frank. WB2BXL, WS2X.
Yeah, KB2 call sign would make me quite a bit younger, I'm flattered. I'm kind of amused by the fact that November 14th at 12:07 a.m. is pretty close to the exact time I was born, and it will be 65 years ago. So it's a heck of a birthday present. I guess they planned it that way. What can I say? that's kind of amusing. And with regard to the Apollo rover mission, if I remember correctly, the criteria was that they couldn't go any further from the lunar module than their walk-back distance. That is the distance it was practical for them to get out of the rover, leave the rover behind, and walk back if the rover broke down or the batteries went dead or something. Go ahead.
That's very true. That's why, even though the last rover drove around for 17 miles, over three EVAs, they never went further than probably, two and a half miles away, maybe at the most. That would be it. So yeah, they knew that, and then the timing had to be right. There's so much oxygen, in their suits, they can't be too far away, and then it's going to take them forever to walk back to the left. That was all calculated, and mission control many times told them, get back in and start head back heading, I remember hearing that years ago. And very good. And another, I know you follow the SpaceX flight, Frank, too. I don't know if you got a chance to see the Falcon Heavy takeoff just the other day. Very successful. Just Tuesday, less than a week ago. They did a geosynchronous flight for the Space Force. But that's a massive rocket when you put the three of them together. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, I think I saw some of the video of that. Got apparently most of the sticks back, but not all of them, which is the trajectory Space Force needed. And I know one of the videos I saw kind of confused Falcon Heavy with Super Heavy, which is two very different things. It looks like, according to the guesstimate, seems to be, by the way, let me know what you think, that Super Heavy is not going to go until March. So I'm beginning to wonder if even that's going to happen. Go ahead.
Well, I know he keeps saying, he's optimistic, it's going up next week, But, yeah, I agree. I wouldn't be surprised if it was delayed until March. We'll see. Falcon 9 Heavy was, the two boosters, the port and starboard came back very successful. Came back to Cape Canaveral, landed on landing zone 1 and 2, which he took that over from Launch Complex 13 that was unused. So that's where those came back. It was very foggy that day. I watched it take off live. But you did see it come back. And the core stage, they let that go into the Atlantic because they needed the extra fuel to, like what you said before, to push these two large satellites for the government up to geosynchronous orbit. They had to relight the second stage a couple of times. So with all of that, they managed to get them to where they were supposed to be at 23,000 miles above the Earth. So I'm looking at the time. Super Heavy is you're trying to launch a rocket with 30 engines all simultaneously. He's got 27 engines on the Falcon Heavy. So, what's three more? Now they say they're producing one Raptor engine per day. Raptor engines are the ones that they use for the Super Heavy. The Merlin engines are the ones that they use for the ones that are in present day use on the Falcon 9 rocket. But we'll see. All right, if anybody does have anybody else, let's see if we have a comment or two. Almost 5:05. Remember to set all my clocks back. Any other comments? WSQS. Although, as usual, when I forget, a week from now, I'll say, hey, had a wrong time on that one. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2M, for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all your help with the TechNet. And thank you for all your help with the club. Everyone appreciates it. I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had a fun time. I hope you come back next Sunday when we'll do it all again. Hopefully I'll find a puzzle or two. These things come infrequently. Fortunately, I had a bunch of them this past week. I want to remind everyone of how Dick used to end these technical nets. Be kind to each other. You always be kind to each other, especially these days. We live in curious days. So be kind to yourself and to others, your friends, your enemies, everyone. We're all in this together. So I also want to remind people of good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep that in mind. I want to remind people, lunar eclipse Tuesday early in the morning. So if you're an insomniac, check it out, take some pictures, and share it with people. Of course, election day is coming, so please, every last one of you, vote. Don't just kind of make nasty comments for the next year like someone else did it to you. Vote. So everyone, have a safe week. Be well, and please come back and join me next Sunday night. I'll do it all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this Eastern Standard Time Lunar Eclipse Pre-Eclipse Election Day edition of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear.
I think you guys know the unofficial engineering term for the SpaceX Super Heavy. I believe the acronym is BFR. And I won't spell out what that acronym stands for. WB2BF. So have a good night, guys. Good night.
You're welcome, Frank. They stole it from BFG. I think it was in Doom or something.
Oh, from Frank Herbert Doom?
No, I think it was from the first-person shooter Doom, D-O-O-M.
Oh, okay. I'm not into first-person shooter games, but I think I can figure out what the acronym stands for. That's good. I'm wondering also about that project in Poland. You said that's first getting started and not going to be ready to go for quite a number of years.
Yeah, it's going to break ground, I think, in 2026. And the first one will be up in 2033. And then they'll be rolling them out every 2 to 3 years is the way that they announced this project.
Yeah, too bad it's going to take so long. It sounds like Ukraine is going to need something right now to get power into them, since the Russians have blown up all their power plants. Maybe the Poles will figure out a way to do something really, really quick. Anyway, seriously, I know it's getting late. WB2BF.
Yes, indeed. It's getting late. I mean, my biological clock thinks it's 12:08. I don't think it's a good idea to speed up the manufacture and building of nuclear reactors. The Chinese got a short-term fame from building a, quote, hospital, end quote, in 30 days. That thing collapsed about 3 days later. So I think we should give them all the time that they need to build it nice and strong.
Boy, we need good union workers on that job, and it'll be built well. And it'll take long, but it will be done well.
Well, since Elon has nothing to do with it, my hope is that they do have union workers. I don't know what the union presentation is in Poland these days. Another thing that would be useful to ask Wesley.
I agree. Very good. And I like the original name, Mars Colony Transport, MCT. That was the original name for this. You should have never changed it and then change it to these ridiculous letters that everybody makes fun of. That's not good. What are you going to do? I don't think he's going to Mars anytime soon. Anyway, 73, Roy.
Yeah, I tend to take everything he says with a grain of salt, so he's not really good with schedules.
With following the Warren Act, either.
He's not particularly good following any law or regulation. The Securities Exchange Commission, there's a laundry list of people getting ready to sharpen their knives and go at him. He's making more enemies every day. It's rather amazing how you can do that.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. You know, he's got to sell cars to, you know, everybody. You know, you don't want to make enemies. You go into the background and, you know what does he do? He goes all the way out and buys up a social media company. Wow. Anyway, take care, Roy.
Okay, Paul, be well, and we'll talk again next week. Thank you.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m.
Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. Line mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
To RBP Mobile.
Good morning, Matt. KD2KNH.
How's it going? My wife and I went to Captain Bill's last night. So I had like, what I had. I had, my appetizer, had big clams that were really good, and then I had like this linguine with shrimp, and then I had like bread pudding for dessert. It was good, it was really good. It was like $44 per person. The union gives me like an honorarium check for being an officer. They gave me like $75. They used it for dinner.
Well, however you pay for it, man, it's always